Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Daughters of Chivalry, The Forgotten Princesses of King Edward Longshanks, by Kelsey Wilson Lee. Narrated by Christine Rendell. Publisher's note. This audiobook may refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. Introduction. Close your eyes and think of a medieval princess. Do you see a woman clothed in vibrant silks and rich velvets, her head, hands and waist girdled with gleaming gold and sparkling gemstones? Is she sitting at a table, creaking under the weight of exotic foods, with precious wines spilling from silver vessels onto fine linens, against a backdrop of tapestries woven with romantic heroes and heroines, or in a painted hall, heraldic banners fluttering behind, proclaiming her royal status and connections? Or is she riding a magnificent horse through a forest with a hunt? Or travelling from one luxurious palace to the next in a decorated carriage, stopping to preside over jousting tournaments from raised pavilions, or to add lustre to the dais at major feasts and festivals? Despite the richness of her surroundings, in your mind, is she ultimately a mere pawn to be traded for the political gain of her father? Are her concerns confined to the beauty of the trinkets that surround her? Is she acquiescent, a person whom the most important things happen to or for, rather than an actor in her own right? There is no doubt that stories of medieval princesses that have built an empire of fairy stories, Hollywood films, theme parks, and cheaply produced ball gowns all offer a vision of maidenhood focused on passive virtue. Medieval castles promote visits to princess towers, reinforcing the link between royal women in history and their powerless fictional counterparts, locked inside or frozen in deathless sleep, condemned simply to wait, their eventual reward, marriage to a male saviour. It is a vision that real medieval princesses would not have recognised in their lives. Between the end of the Middle Ages, which, depending on whom you ask, occurred in England in the quarter century or so before or after 1500, and the mid-19th century, no one cared much about princesses. History was the preserve of great men, kings and bishops, conquerors and tyrants, and even the popular fictional heroines from the dawn of the novel, Fanny Burney's Evelina, Thackeray's Becky Sharp, or Austen's many wonderful women, were isolated from power, confined to the lower rungs of the county gentry or the middle classes. Then, in 1837, an 18-year-old girl raised in England became Queen Regnant, the first woman to rule her country since Queen Anne's reign, more than 120 years earlier. The countless ways in which Victoria and her long reign shaped Britain, its society, and ultimately its empire, have long captured public imagination. How her rule and the lives of her five princess daughters prompted a popular interest in royal women is also of immense significance. The first volume in a pioneering study of medieval women, Lives of the Queens of England, was published 3 years after Victoria came to the throne, written by Agnes Strickland, a poet who undertook research in partnership with her sister Elizabeth. In the decade that followed, the historian Mary Ann Everett Green published Letters of Royal and Illustrious Ladies of Great Britain, that for the first time gave a voice to medieval and early modern noblewomen. Her subsequent six-volume masterpiece, Lives of the Princesses of England from the Norman Conquest, used her command of Latin and medieval French, and her access to original manuscripts, letters, and charters to construct short biographies of every princess between the reigns of William the Conqueror and Victoria. It remains one of the outstanding achievements of 19th century biography. Across Europe at this time, as nations emerged from the Industrial Revolution, many of them developed an increasingly romanticized interest in their own histories and native mythologies, seeking connection to a pastoral, pre-industrialized past. In England, this led not only to a widespread interest in the lives of long-dead queens and princesses, but also in other aspects of the Middle Ages. Art and architecture began to feature distinctly medieval elements, such as the Gothic Revival Palace of Westminster, and literary works such as Alfred Lord Tennyson's poem, Idylls of the King, which converted the ancient myth of King Arthur and his court at Camelot into a national epic, and paintings and stained glass panels by the artists known as the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood and their followers depicted scenes from medieval romances and folk tales, Guinevere and the Lady of the Lake, Fair Rosamond and Isolde, that brought these old stories to new audiences that were hungry to understand what set England apart from other nations. The romanticising tendency of mostly male Victorian historians made it easy for genuine historical figures such as Fair Rosamond Clifford and the royal women that Strickland and Green wrote about to be melded in popular imagination alongside fictional heroines. Together with the Guineveres and Isoldas of medieval romance, the passive princesses of the fairy tales compiled by the German brothers, Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm, whose works were translated into 19 separate English editions during Victoria's reign, became so well known that they created an expectation that real princesses would conform to these models. It was a pattern perfectly constructed for the burgeoning Victorian middle class, for whom a wife kept at home, safe from the tawdry bustle of the city and the labour market, was a mark of success. They took these newly idealised visions of princesses found in poems and artworks, acquiescent, serene beauties, and held them up as prime examples of womanhood. In many ways, we have failed to move on from the vision of the medieval past that we inherited from the Victorian era. Most of us, when we hear the word princess, still imagine a damsel trapped in a tower, like the eponymous heroine of Tennyson's Lady of Shalott, loosely based on the medieval Arthurian tale of Elaine of Astolat. Tennyson's maiden lives full royally apparelled, sleeping on a velvet bed with a garland of pearls encircling her head. Despite the luxury of her chamber, all is not well. She lives alone in a tower encircled by a fence of thorny roses, and though the people passing hear her chanting cheerily, like an angel singing clearly, they never visit. Inside the tower, the lady is entranced, forbidden by an unspoken curse from looking directly at the beauty of the world and Camelot. She must instead continually weave a tapestry depicting its glory through the dimmed reflection of a mirror. Finally, one day, Sir Lancelot rides by, his armour and horse trappings glittering in the bright sunlight like one burning flame a meteor trailing light. Overcome by the sight of his coal-black curls, the lady escapes her tower and sets out in a boat towards Camelot, determined to find her knight. But the nameless curse cannot be evaded, and by the time her boat reaches the city, she is no more than a beautiful corpse, which means that her virginity, first signalled by the roses that guarded her bower, has remained intact, despite her evident desire for Lancelot. The lesson is simple. It was the lady's rejection of the boundaries that had been set for her that spelled her doom. Her action could not go unpunished. Dozens of paintings of the Lady of Shalott, and the inspiration for her, Elaine of Astolat, survive from the late 19th century. She represented a perfect tragic heroine for the Victorians. Shades of her story are also present in the fairy tales of princesses that have come down to us from the Brothers Grimm. Rapunzel, trapped in a tower. Snow White, prized for her purity. And Sleeping Beauty, preserved beautifully in sleep. While Tennyson's Lady was inspired by real medieval romances, his telling of her tale was a very partial vision of the past, selected to suit the tastes of the world that popularized it. Other female icons of the Middle Ages were considerably more active in the ways in which they sought to control their lives, and at the time many were praised for it. There were the virgin martyrs, many of whom were thought to be scholarly princesses. Agatha, Catherine, Margaret, and Lucy, who fearlessly defied their fathers, and even kings, who sought to control their bodies and minds. Though stories from these saints' lives are largely fictitious, they were held aloft in the medieval period as exemplars for young noblewomen. Highly sympathetic portrayals of secular women living outside the strictures of conventional morality also abounded in romantic fiction and courtly poetry. Famous heroines, such as Guinevere and Isolde, who threw caution to the wind, engaging in forbidden affairs, as well as lesser-known maidens and princesses who married virtuous but poor knights, enriching and empowering them through their love. For noble women, there were also numerous historic examples of powerful queens and formidable and cunning consorts, such as Eleanor of Aquitaine and Blanche of Castile, whose own considerable contributions to medieval culture and history have only recently begun to receive the attention they deserve. These medieval narratives have largely been forgotten because they did not fit with the values of the intervening age. The women who grew up surrounded by the original narratives were not normally even referred to as princesses until the 16th century, but rather ladies or daughters of the king, and they had a much more fluid relationship with power, influence and action than it suited most Victorian storytellers to recall. Undeniably, their world was brutally patriarchal, and the odds were stacked against any woman who wanted to exercise autonomy, even among the most privileged. Contemporary society divided itself into those who were labourers, priests and warriors, seemingly leaving noble women without any social role to play. It was a world in which the doers were overwhelmingly male. But feudalism, the medieval governing system by which land was ultimately owned by lords, with the use of it offered out for services rendered to them by vassals, necessitated a rigid social hierarchy. For women from the social elite, there was the chance that their status could trump their gender. The most successful among them learned to work within, or even use the cultural frameworks of feudalism and chivalry, the social and moral code that governed the behaviour of aristocrats, to achieve considerable influence at the courts of their fathers, brothers, and husbands. Indeed, it might surprise one to learn that the medieval princess may have been more than the finely dressed ornament of popular imagination. She might have been a commander of castle garrisons under attack from hostile forces, and a seasoned war traveller. She might have been a diplomat, savvy at negotiating international trade agreements, a specialist at using soft power to avert the threat of military confrontation. She may have wielded absolute power over vast estates, scandalized court by secretly marrying an unknown paramour, or disrupted the vows of other unions. Through her patronage of literature and music, her role as a devoted mother and educator to her children, and her own scholarship, she might have helped shape the age in which she lived. And through the cunning manipulation of powerful men and cultural conventions, she may have gained significant power and freedoms to forge her own path in life. What follows is the story of five medieval princesses, sisters who used their connections and their knowledge of courtly culture to gain and wield considerable power and influence. History has until now utterly overlooked these women and the part they played in shaping England's story. And yet, far from being the passive maidens of fiction, these real-life princesses sought active participation in their own destinies, cultivating authority and deploying financial and political resources to achieve their aims. Occasionally they even defied their father, the king. But more commonly, they used the power and resources that they were able to muster to promote the interests of England and their family. In so doing, they affirmed their allegiance to their kingly father or brother, whose connection guaranteed their exceptional lives. But through their promotion of English interests, the sisters also stuck a claim that they were playing an important role in the family business, a business to which they would devote their lives, and a role which required them to have privileged access to decision-making. Despite, or perhaps because of their willful personalities and bold actions, they maintained their influence at court for as long as the king held power. In the middle of November 1272, Henry III, King of England for 56 years, died after a long illness. His eldest son, Edward, succeeded him immediately, though he was not crowned until 1274. 2 years before his father's death, Edward and his Castilian wife, Eleanor, had sailed from England to join a united European army led by King Louis IX of France, Edward's uncle, bound on crusade. Their three small children, 4-year-old John, 2-year-old Henry, and the infant princess, Eleonora, were left back in England. The children lived in a small household, first under the guardianship of their father's respected and powerful uncle, Richard, Earl of Cornwall, and after his death, under the protection of their queenly grandmother, Eleanor of Provence. Their years abroad did not bring the success Edward had hoped for. Most of the Crusade's leaders, including his kingly French uncle, died before arriving in the Holy Land, and the army was thus too small to stand a chance at re-establishing a Christian kingdom of Jerusalem. Either way, with the responsibility of kingship thrust upon him by his father's death, Edward was forced to return home. However, of their three children, only 6-year-old Henry and his 5-year-old sister, Eleonora, awaited their parents on shore when the royal fleet docked at Dover, late in the summer of 1274. John, their eldest son and heir, had died 2 years previously. The Queen had given birth to 3 more children during their years away, 2 of whom survived. There was a daughter, 3 years younger than Eleonora, Joanna, called of Acre, in recognition of her birth at the port city that was the only surviving vestige of a Christian kingdom in the Holy Land, and also a son, Alfonso, named in honour of his Castilian grandfather. Born in Gascony during the homeward journey, Alfonso was only 8 months old when he arrived in England with his parents. His sister Joanna had been left in the care of her maternal grandmother, Jeanne de Dammartin, Dowager Queen of Castile. Queen Jeanne, who now lived as a widow in the northern French county of Ponthieu, which she held by her own right, persuaded her homeward-bound crusader daughter to leave the toddler princess with her for company. Alone of her siblings, therefore, Joanna's earliest memories were of France rather than England, and her unique early experiences abroad may account for some of the exceptional independence that she would demonstrate in later life. This is the forgotten story of Eleonora and Joanna, and of their 3 sisters who would be born after their father became king, Margaret, Mary, and Elizabeth. 13 years separated the births of the eldest and youngest royal daughters, an age gap that ensured the women had distinct experiences, and that the relationships that forged their adult personalities and priorities were distinct. What they shared with each other and their brothers were the ways in which their childhoods, and to a remarkable extent, their adult lives were shaped by their father's ambition to build an empire. This is a chronicle of the High Middle Ages with a difference. It is the story of what happened just off-centre from the king around whom court coalesced, among his own children. The story of how these royal women lived and learned how to have an impact on their world. The story of 5 real princesses in the age of chivalry. And, like all chronicles of a reign, it begins with a coronation. Chapter 1. Coronation. 1274. London. Guildford. The capital was adorned like Camelot, with yards of cloth billowing down and providing splashes of riotous colour against the grime of ancient buildings. A fanfare welcomed Edward I, known as Longshanks for his great height, and his wife, the Castilian Princess Eleanor, as they triumphantly entered London for their coronation. The date was 18 August 1274. Edward and Eleanor had been abroad on crusade for 4 years, and their arrival in London was the culmination of a grand 16-day ceremonial progression inland from their landing site at Dover. According to the chronicler, Thomas Wickes, neither tongue nor pen would suffice to describe the ornament of the city and its citizens, arrayed without regard for expenditure, in honour of the King's Majesty. Through the tangle of narrow city streets, the King and his entourage wound slowly westwards, maximizing their visibility to the throngs of Londoners who were seeking a glimpse of their new monarch. The parade ended at the Royal Palace at Westminster to the west of the city, before the Great Abbey Church, which had been rebuilt at tremendous expense in the fashionable French Gothic style by Edward's father, and where Edward and Eleanor were to be crowned the following day. More than a generation had passed since the last coronation of Edward's mother, Eleanor of Provence, in 1236, and the crowning of the returning Crusader king promised to be a joyous spectacle. The preparations for the coronation had begun the previous winter. Kitchens had been erected on the outskirts of the sprawling palace to prepare a coronation feast for thousands. Across the country, orders were placed for provisions, with sheriffs from 12 counties charged with supplying extraordinary numbers of animals for the roast meats. Over 20,000 capons and hens, 500 oxen, and the same number of sheep and swine for roasting on the day were sought from as far away as Somerset and Gloucestershire, while over 300 bacon pigs had already been required at Windsor by Easter for slaughter and salting. Bishops, abbots, and priors throughout England were required to provide as many swans, peacocks, cranes, rabbits, and kid goats as they could capture from their estates. Immense quantities of fish, including lampreys, eels, pike, and salmon, were also secured. Special laws were brought in to keep prices down for the king's buyers by explicitly forbidding fishmongers from buying stock in bulk in an effort to profit from the exceptional demand. Alongside these provisions, new stables and lodges, many of them temporary constructions, were built to house the hundreds of knights who would journey to see their new king crowned. The pageant reached its climax the following day, the Sunday after the Feast of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin, when the young royal couple walked from Westminster Palace to the Abbey through a newly erected covered walkway that crisscrossed the square separating the two. In London, the conduit at Cheapside, which normally channeled fresh water into the city, ran with wine to slake the thirst of revellers on the hot summer day. Back at Westminster, amid the fluttering heraldic banners and golden robes that glinted in the sun, tensions ran high as leading nobles and churchmen clashed over the rights to perform ceremonial roles in the coronation. The king's own brother, Edmund, known as Crouchback, or Crossed Back, for his participation in the Crusade, an activity already commonly associated with knights wearing cross-embroidered tunics, seems to have either boycotted the ceremony itself or been prohibited from attending, after he was refused the right he claimed to carry katana, the great sword of state said to have belonged to the legendary hero Tristan. Instead, the sword was carried before the king by one of his most troublesome subjects, and his future son-in-law, Gilbert, the Earl of Gloucester. The Archbishop of York was also aggrieved. His request to preside at the coronation had been denied, as punishment for the indiscretion of publicly carrying his archiepiscopal crozier, or staff of office, outside of his own province, a clear and deliberate attempt to claim precedence over his rival, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who conducted the ceremony alone. Waiting for the new young king inside the abbey were the retinues of the chief lords of his realm, his mother, the Dowager Queen Eleanor of Provence, and his two sisters, Margaret and Beatrice, along with their husbands, the King of Scotland and the Duke of Brittany. Before this assembly, Edward spoke the traditional vows sworn by...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?